From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Today, the cultural evolution of the 1990s. Racial relations, politics, music, fashion, even the definition of fame and success changed in that decade. And the housing market was hot through the 1990s, and then the recession hit. So can you now find bargain mansions in Georgia? That's all coming up this hour. First, though, let's revisit yesterday's show, and that's when we talked about the confusing costs of funerals.
When you look at the price spread that we found in Atlanta, on the low end, you found $850 for a direct cremation. On the high end, you found $3,640. Take the burial side. Look at $1,195 for a simple no-service burial, $5,200 for a simple no-service burial. There is no way that the customer with a simple cremation and no ceremony is getting $3,000 more worth of service than the person at the $850.
We also talked about the funerals of those who can't afford to be buried and are instead placed in so-called pauper's graves. Here are your first thoughts. Sergeant Stumpy tweeted us, "One of my mom's dead husband's remains are in there somewhere. She got the cheapest cremation she could find. He was not a nice man. Our condolences." We also talked about Jewish culture in the South and the Jewish community's role in the civil rights movement. Robbie Medwed tweeted to let us know he couldn't listen to the conversation live, and we hope, Robbie, you got to listen to it later online. But Robbie left us this voicemail about his own experience being Jewish in the South.
I grew up in the South. I'm a native of Atlanta, and I grew up with a little bit of anti-Semitism here and there. And I remember being told by my parents when we went on road trips not to tell people that we were Jewish. And even now, to this day, I still get a lot of casual anti-Semitism. These people ask if I go to that Jewish church.
Thank you so much for calling in. We always want to hear what you have to say. Call us like Robbie did at 404-500-9457. We are also on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio, and we might feature your comments on the show. You know the saying, go big or go home? In Georgia, you can do both. You can go big when you buy a home. Georgia is tied for second when it comes to states with the highest percentage of mansions listed for less than $1 million. The real estate listing site Trulia issued the list recently. Their housing economist, Ralph McLaughlin, joins us to talk about the so-called bargain mansions. Welcome, Ralph.
Good morning, Celeste.
And to get a sense of where you might find these homes, we have real estate agent Susan Thompson from Keller Williams Realty in Buckhead, and she specializes in the luxury home market. Hi, Susan.
Hi, how are you?
What qualifies as a luxury home? Is it a price point?
Yeah, there's different price points. Nationally, a lot of people will use $500,000 and up. In the local Atlanta area, we tend to use $750,000 and up.
So let me ask you the same question, Ralph. What qualifies a home as a mansion?
Well, a mansion is probably the most nebulous thing to define, and it depends where you are in the country, obviously. A shack out here is roughly the same price as some luxury mansions in Atlanta.
You said sorry, Ralph, where are you?
San Francisco.
Right.
Out here in San Francisco. So what we wanted to do is actually look at the size of new homes that were being built, and the median size of the new home is about 2,700 square feet. So we wanted to look at something that was a little over double that size. So we looked at the share of homes sold for under $1 million that were over 6,000 square feet.
And tell me a little bit about the cities that came in near the top of that list. Were there common denominators other than just the fact that they had a lot of big homes selling for lower prices?
Yeah, well, we looked at states and not cities, and the three states that came up to the top were Utah, Georgia, and Indiana. And I think what's common about those states is three things, really. Construction costs tend to be low. In fact, if you look at construction costs per square foot in those states, they're around $70 a square foot. Land prices tend to be low in those states. And those states, it's also relatively easy to obtain permits. So, the theme here is that the cost to build mansions in these states are low. If you were to, say, compare the cost per square foot to build a home or a mansion out here in California, it's $100, $105 a square foot. So we think that's really what's driving that difference.
So, Susan, how does this coincide with your knowledge being out on the street trying to sell these homes? Have you seen a large number of large luxury homes going for relatively reasonable prices?
Yeah, my data shows not so much in the new construction market as opposed to the houses that were built basically between 2004 and 2008 before the market crashed. I'm seeing quite a number of houses, and I've participated in quite a number of sales of houses that are selling well below $1 million in the price per square foot basis that he's discussing.
That Ralph's talking about.
Yeah, that Ralph's talking about. Of course, I'm only looking at the metro area. I don't really have knowledge of what's potentially happening in Macon or Columbus, Georgia, or something like that. There could be the potential for new construction, because he said it's the entire state,
yeah,
that new construction is selling at that price point.
Okay, well, there you go. That's an invitation. If you work in real estate in Macon or Savannah or anywhere else in the state, you can give us the data from the street as you see it. But, Susan, I wonder, what were these houses, what were they going for when they were first built?
Those houses originally probably sold well over $1 million, maybe $1.1 million, $1.2 million. And today, now they're competing with a lot of new construction in some of our outlying areas like Milton or Smyrna or West Cobb or Duluth up at Sugarloaf or places like that where there's large, really that McMansion kind of a feel, that sold for pretty high dollars between 2004, 2008. And now they're competing with brand new construction that may resonate a little bit better with today's buyer.
Maybe because, as Ralph was saying, it's relatively cheap to build here.
Well, that and the fact that, you know, basically people in the last 10 to 12 years have a different stylized version of what their house should look like. So the new buyer is looking for different things than what the 2004 to 2008 home had.
Ralph, what is your experience, Trulia, looking nationally at what Susan is describing, the fact that people would rather build new because we've entered a different style of home these days?
Yeah, it's tough to put a finger on exactly whether or not that's going on, but certainly new construction on average tends to sell for about 20% more than existing homes, we're entering a new generation of buyers. Millennials are now starting to emerge and buy. They're not necessarily buying new homes quite yet, but maybe seeing generational shifts. And of course, every generation has their own preferences for what they like to see in a home, whether it's the type of home or the amenities within a home. So that certainly could be the case, not just in Georgia and Atlanta, but also nationally.
One of the things, Ralph, that a number of people have talked about is that maybe we're downsizing, that people are starting, there has been a large movement towards smaller homes. And I wonder if that's part of these style changes that you and Susan are talking about.
There has been a lot of discussion about that, but we run several consumer surveys every year. And what we're finding is actually, that sentiment, that idea really isn't playing out, at least in consumers' preferences.
People saying they want smaller homes, but they don't actually buy them. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. In fact, the group that wants to upsize the most are actually millennials. Maybe that's because they're still living in their parents' basements. But but overall, consumers are saying they want to live in big homes. They want to live in homes that are at least 2,000 square feet or larger. So the trend to live in small micro units in downtowns, if that is occurring, it's probably only occurring because of necessity, not because of widespread generational shifts in demand.
Susan, what do you think in your realty, in your sales, are you seeing people tending towards smaller?
I think that we had a lot of houses, and I'm only talking on the luxury end here.
Yeah.
So on the luxury end, we had a lot of houses that were 8, 10, 12, 13,000 square feet. I've sold two in the last year. That if you looked at any kind of estimate online, Trulia, anybody, they were estimating these houses should go between 2.2 and 2.5. They were on, estate-sized lots, and they're huge. So, and that tended to be a phenomenon in the late 90s and, you know, up to about 2005, where people were building these huge McMansions.
Yeah.
That kind of a thing, I think, is a bygone era, where we are seeing people not want to have 13,000 square foot with an elevator. 6,000 square feet is that's a large home, and anybody's I don't have a 6,000
square feet, you know, is really
right
large.
That's a large home, but it's not as large as some of what we used to see. And I do think that people, clearly the millennials are moving up and out and want larger, and people do want a house that accommodates all of their needs, but they're not looking for those homes on steroids anymore.
Well, Ralph, what does this all mean for the rest of us who are not buying even a 6,000 square foot house, who think that 1,600 square feet is quite a bit? Is there a connection between the real estate of these luxury homes and mansions that you're talking about and real estate for the majority of the people?
Yeah. So, you know, there does tend to be, somewhat of a trickle-down effect when it comes to demand. We've certainly seen that here in San Francisco with the average buyer. And, in Atlanta, I think that principle still holds. Atlanta tends to be, actually very, very affordable. So affordable homes at any price point means, demand for homes there aren't necessarily squeezing out demand for homes that are slightly lower priced or slightly smaller. And so if we were to, say, look at a different metric, let's just say the number of homes that have five bedrooms or more, Atlanta is, very, very affordable. You know, the median price on a five-bedroom home is, about $375,000. That looks like chump change compared to many other parts of the country.
Certainly in San Francisco, that's for sure.
Yeah, and even in places like Los Angeles, it's, approaching $1 million. Miami is $600,000. Seattle's, $584,000 for a five-bedroom home. So I think the moral of the story here is Atlanta just tends to be overall relatively affordable and a bargain compared to many other parts of the country.
And Susan is nodding her head in agreement. That is Ralph McLaughlin. He's a housing economist at Trulia. And Susan Thompson is a real estate agent specializing in luxury homes. She's with Keller Williams Realty in Buckhead. Susan and Ralph, thank you both so much.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
If you need a reminder that not every mansion in Georgia is actually a bargain, check out our Facebook page. You'll find a listing there for a $48 million house in Sandy Springs. Or if that's not the kind of thing that you want to live in, how about a bunker? For $17.5 million, you could be the proud owner of an underground complex equipped with luxury apartments, several bedrooms, and a home theater. That's in Tifton, Georgia. Bruce Kitchens is with Bastion Holdings, the company that owns that property, and he spoke with the Fox affiliate in Albany.
This place will protect you against anything, hurricanes, tornadoes, any kind of storms. Of course, it's designed to withstand the 20-kiloton nuclear bomb. The walls are about 3 feet thick. This place is impenetrable.
The bunker was actually built by the Army Corps of Engineers during the Cold War in 1969. And also we get this tweet from Cynthia Turner, who says, and then there's Athens, which has some seriously overpriced sections of town. You can give us your real estate report by tweeting us, as Cynthia did, at OST Talker. Go to our Facebook page. This is On Second Thought. The 90s were the most significant decade of my life. I graduated from college in the 90s. I began singing opera professionally. I became a mother. I started my career in public radio. And as all of that was unfolding, which only I care about, the world around me was changing.
Nelson Mandela, the leader of the African National Congress. He walked out of a prison on a gloriously sunny South African afternoon. And there is general agreement that his freedom begins a new era in South Africa.
We've heard some reports that sound like bomb blasts coming down, and that's been a few minutes ago. All right, Baghdad is beginning to be blacked out now. Large sections of the city losing its lighting.
If it doesn't fit, you must acquit. I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky.
Georgia State University professor Scott Heath describes the 1990s as the Love Jones generation, named after a 1997 film. The decade is the focus of a class Heath teaches, and he's here to talk about it as part of our occasional series, Lessons from Left Field. It's where we learn about unusual class courses. Scott, good to have you back.
Thank you. Good morning.
And also with him are three students in that class, Rebecca Kumar, Kwaku Vassal, and Shari Arnold. Thank you all for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you very
good morning.
Much.
Scott, let's go to you first and explain to me why, if you're covering all the kind of cultural changes that happened in the 1990s, why do you is the framework that movie Love Jones?
I think that Love Jones is interesting because it represents some of the shifts and conversations that were happening in the 90s. The 90s is interesting for us because it's this decade of great anxiety in a way, as we're approaching the end of not just the decade, but a millennium. I think there's a sort of rush to define things. So the 90s begins in black popular culture with a great interest in things, I think, led by gangster rap and a lot of film work that's built around that, films like Boys in the Hood. Love Jones comes around later in the decade, and it's almost an anti-gangster film, almost an anti-hip-hop film, right, that says, okay, let's expand this notion of public blackness in a different direction, right? So we're moving away from, you know, the shoot 'em ups and closer to black people representing a certain type of middle class, people who have gone to college, people who aren't actually doing crime the way that some of the characters in Boys in the Hood or Menace to Society are doing. So there's this new attention to a certain type of intimacy. Love Jones is 1997. 1997 is sort of for us the beginning of our hearing things called neo soul, which is again a turn toward a certain type of intimacy and interior thinking. Right.
Yeah.
So, and there's a nostalgia to it. You know, it's a nostalgic film in a sense.
Let's take a listen to. Here's a clip from that film, Love Jones.
Do you know a lot about photography?
A little some. I know that you have a great eye.
So you're just like a Renaissance black man. Poetry, music, photography.
I think it was somebody that said something about Mozart. The goal of an artist is to create the definitive work that cannot be surpassed. I guess you can say I kind of live like
that. Well, that was actually George Bernard Shaw.
So, Rebecca, you were shaking your head while that clip was playing. But, I mean, to a certain extent, I wonder how much you buy into the theory that Love Jones provides a framework to view the 1990s as a shift in culture.
Oh, that's a good question. I think, like Dr. Heath is saying, I think it signals a shift as the 90s is anticipating the 2000s. I'd say around 1996... there's a kind of break in how we want to define or give shape to blackness, right? And it's a reminder that that it's not just marked by Menace to Society, right? It's not just marked by gangster rap. This is an opening up of, in some ways, possibilities of how we understand love, too. Because some of those other movies that came before are not marked with the kind of tenderness or intimacy as Love Jones. So I don't think it characterizes the entire decade, but it definitely characterizes a turning point in cultural production in the 90s.
And Shari, you have focused during your work in the class on the Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas hearings, is that correct?
Some of it.
Tell me what's significant about the Hill-Thomas hearings. Clarence Thomas, who's now a justice of the Supreme Court, and Anita Hill, who accused him of sexual harassment. Tell me, what about those particular hearings to you signify a pivotal moment?
Some of the things when we talked collectively in class about that moment culturally focus on, first, the dynamics between black men and black women. One of the things we talked about with that was Anita Hill's portrayal in the media and how she came to represent a certain space, and then putting her against Clarence Thomas in that situation really made these like moments of definition that were different from what we were used to seeing. And then another thing we talked about was, interestingly, kind of something we characterized as a use of the race card, so to speak, in a way that Clarence Thomas positioned himself to use that to his advantage for ultimately what his purpose was in that moment, which was to defend himself for this confirmation for this seat. So for me, it was important. I was a kid when that happened in the 90s. So when it happened, you know, I saw it. I didn't understand it beyond just seeing that on TV. But to revisit it, you know, now over 20 years later, it has a different meaning. And so for me today, seeing those images and watching those the footage of the Anita Hill's hearings was different.
Let's take a listen. Here first is Anita Hill. And just a warning for those listening, she is talking about sexual allegations here. It may not be appropriate for all audiences.
He talked about pornographic materials depicting individuals with large penises or large breasts involved in various sex acts. On several occasions, Thomas told me graphically of his own sexual prowess. I told him that I did not want to talk about these subjects.
And here is Clarence Thomas denying wrongdoings, and he also called the hearings themselves a travesty.
As a Black American, as far as I'm concerned, it is a high-tech lynching for uppity Blacks who in any way deign to think for themselves, to do for themselves, to have different ideas. And it is a message that unless you kowtow to an old order, this is what will happen to you.
So, Scott, to a certain extent, Clarence Thomas is kind of referring directly to the thesis of your class curriculum, right? He's talking about a shift in the perception of Blacks and also a debate over what Blackness is. How do you address that in the classroom?
I think he's definitely talking about representation. And, you know, his reference to a high-tech lynching, I think, is really crucial.
Still powerful today.
It's powerful and it's crucial because it's when you think about what's happening at the start of the 1990s, there's this real convergence of the ways that we talk about culture and race and gender and these newer technologies. So the thing about the Clarence Thomas hearings was that they were so public and it was televised and people were glued to their screen waiting to see what's gonna happen. And not to get too much ahead, but some other sort of moments that are crucial for us that happened right around the same time are the Rodney King beating, which was also very much, I mean, it's important to us because of the technological elements. The fact that George Holliday happened to walk out on his balcony with, you know, a video camera probably the size of a cinder block, you know, at the time and took a moment to record this thing that he witnessed. I mean, had he not, we probably would have never heard of Rodney King.
Yeah, it's not a big
deal
today. Everyone is walking around with a video camera in their pocket. It's called your cell phone.
Right.
But back then, the fact that he happened to have a video camera was very unusual.
And they weren't as common. But now today, we rely very heavily on this documentation of these things that are happening in public, especially with regard to our relationship to the state.
Let's take a listen, actually. This is from KABC-TV reporting in 1992 when the riots, the unrest in Los Angeles was sparked by a not guilty verdict in the beating of Rodney King.
That came down at 3:00 this afternoon. We had a lot of people react to it. We had a lot of pleas for calm. And then we had this. And this has been going on for the better part, Anne, I guess, of about 4 hours.
Yeah, I think basically you could say that all hell broke loose in these inferno fires as we've watched one building after another burn to the ground.
All right, so let me get to you, Kwaku, because I wonder to what extent you feel as though the 1990s were a pivotal moment, not just for African Americans, but for minorities in the United States. Do you buy that premise?
I do, absolutely. I think one of the awesome things about this class is that I was born in 1990, so I'm starting from my own experience and looking at what my parents were talking about at that time and what was going on in their community in Philadelphia, and then expanding from that and seeing how they interacted with others and using the material from the class that sets up a context, which is very important for understanding not only their experience, but the experience of other communities simultaneously. And when you have an incident like the Rodney King beating. You have a lot of different factors going on that led up to this particular incident. And so it's good to have an analysis of what was going on, for example, in the Korean community, which affected how they reacted, what was going on in LA in general, politically, socially, economically, which helps to set the stage for that particular incident. So I feel that it's important. It taught me the importance of context in understanding the background information necessary to pull the necessary lesson from what we're learning.
And put context, I guess, what's happening today, which we'll talk about in a moment. But since you mentioned the reaction of the Korean community in Los Angeles, let's again listen to a newscast. This is from 1992 from KCBS-TV reporting on the response. They're talking about Korean merchants here in Los Angeles.
We are on Olympic Boulevard in Koreatown at the Olympic Discount Store. There are 28 men, armed men, everyone with guns, on duty 24 hours a day, they tell me, protecting this store. They have done such a job here, they won't let me in, they won't let anyone in.
And Rebecca, this is something you're focusing on during your classwork, is it not?
Correct. That's my contribution, one of my contributions to the archive. The 1990s, like for Kwaku, was a formative time in my life. I was born in 84. And in the 1990s, I think if you were, you know, Asian or at least of color, you were kind of caught between two worlds, you know, two kind of cultural worlds, a white world and a black world. And I remember the Rodney King uprising really vividly, mostly because I saw the position of Asians on TV and that complex position of the proximity to different communities and different race relations, of which from back home you do not know. So for me, it was really formative. My contribution is to kind of nuance this understanding a little bit more, think about where the tensions come from. And they've really been brewing for longer than 1992. It begins with 1965. Up until 1965, there was a quota of how many Asians were actually allowed into the United States. And in 1965 was the 1965 Immigration Act that let South Asians and East Asians into the United States. Incidentally, it was also the same year as the Civil Rights Voting Act. It was the same year as the assassination of Malcolm X. So in some ways, symbolically, that just kind of shows a little bit of the divisions that were to come. So by the time 1990 rolled around, they had actually expanded that Immigration Act. And those tensions were being felt. You know, unlike the European immigrants that had come before, South Asian and East Asian immigrants, highly educated. They had money from back home. They were coming in and they were investing in what was affordable areas right to them, but turned out to be predominantly African American. So it's really, a clash of histories of two communities not knowing anything about one another, but being right forced to live near one another.
So, Scott, this brings me back to you because I have to assume that the real purpose of the class is not just to teach the history of the 90s, but also to give students a context for some of the unrest that we see today.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, the idea behind the archive as well. You know, I think we're at this point, if you haven't noticed, there's a lot of talk back to the 90s going on right now.
Sorry, can you explain? We haven't explained what the archive is yet.
Oh, we haven't explained what the archive is. So the class is called The Black 90s, Archiving the Love Jones Generation, but my idea was to build a project that stretched beyond a graduate seminar, right? So what we're actually constructing and will be uploading in the next couple of weeks is a digital archive, a critical archive of the Black 90s, an archive that focuses on a lot of these pivotal moments that happened during that decade, particularly in Black popular culture and Black public culture. I'm speaking toward our interest in screen culture, which does seem to begin or become quite entrenched in the 90s when you think about what we were able to see in terms of the L.A. uprisings, what we're able to see in terms of the O.J. Simpson trial, what we're able to see in terms of the Clarence Thomas hearings, what we're able to see with the advent of reality television, this idea that we're able to now screen ourselves and control what's on that screen. Way before the invention of what we know as the avatar today, people are constantly, you know, mythologizing and reconstructing and reinventing themselves on screen. So this has some precedent for this, right? And I think as much as we were sort of nostalgic in the 90s, and when I say nostalgic in the 90s, I'm thinking about things like in hip-hop culture, the sort of interest in sampling and things like that. We're already reaching back. We're doing that again, and in terms of our cultural movements now and protest movements now, you know, I see people turning back to the 90s and turning back to some of the models that we saw represented during that time.
That is Georgia State University Professor Scott Heath. He teaches The Black 90s, Archiving the Love Jones Generation. If you haven't watched the movie Love Jones, you probably should. It's kind of a, you know, it's become a cult film, but it's also a good film. We also heard from three of his students, Rebecca Kumar, Kwaku Vassell, and Shari Arnold. Thanks so much to all four of you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This conversation is part of our Lessons from Left Field series. If you have a class you think we should profile, let us know. You can call 404-500-9457, and you can also tweet us. It's at OST Talk. This is On Second Thought.
Let's have some really good fruit now.
Really good fruit.
Peaches and pears.
Now, here's something that might make an appearance on your holiday table. Peaches. Georgia has been synonymous with the peach for more than 100 years, but is this peach a Southern success because it's so delicious? Fuzz actually has more to do with it than you might think, says at least one Georgia professor, Thomas Oakey. He teaches history at Kennesaw State University, and he's written about the significance of peach skin and all that fine fuzz that comes with it. It's in his forthcoming book, The Georgia Peach: Culture, Agriculture, and Environment in the American South. And he joins me now. Hi, Tom.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Dan Horton. He's Professor Emeritus of Entomology at the University of Georgia. So, Dan, you're going to tell us all about insects, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And Al Pearson is a fourth-generation peach farmer and co-owner of Pearson Farms. Al, it's good to have you as well.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
How many peaches, Al, do you farm and harvest every year?
We have about 1,500 acres of peaches that occupy us.
Do you have any idea what the number of peaches that translates to?
That would be about whatever 500,000 times 60 years.
That's a lot.
30 million, something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that's a lot of peaches, I'll say that. Okay, but let me go to you first, Tom, because this is your theory of kind of going with peach fuzz to talk about the importance of why the peach is so important to Georgia. So give me the elevator pitch. What's your theory here?
It's really just a way of thinking about one reason why the Georgia peach was successful. You had, in the 19th century, all these horticulturists who wanted to grow all kinds of fruits, gooseberries and citrus and pears and plums and grapes. And peaches were the one thing that kind of stuck. And I think part of the reason for that is the fuzz that does provide a little bit of resistance to the pests. Now, I'm no scientist. Dan Horton can talk.
That's why we've got Dan
with more
here.
Authority on how insects like the fuzz. But I think it's an interesting way of thinking about the peach's environmental adaptation to the South.
And peaches are not originally native to Georgia. All of these things were brought in here to experiment.
That's right. Well, peaches actually came over with Jesuit friars in the 16th century. So they've been here for quite a long time. They're practically native. They're from China originally.
Okay. So when you talk about the peach fuzz making a difference, why do you say that? Why? I mean, the difference between we've been saying it over and over, the difference between a peach and a nectarine is just that fuzz. So what was it about the fuzz that made that particularly attractive to Georgians?
Well, this is an environment with a lot of pests. It's humid. We don't have really harsh winters. So we have a lot of pests. I think the fact that peaches succeeded in a way that nectarines never have is in part because insects and pathogens can't get a grip on the peach in quite the same way that they can on nectarines or plums, say.
Haha, that brings us to you, Dan.
So
tell me about the peach fuzz. And, I mean, is there an evolutionary benefit for the peach to have that fuzz?
Well, this is going to ramble off into theory rather than hard science.
I'll try and edit you.
Please do. Peach fuzz is like many other traits present in plants that will discourage an assortment of pests. If you think of it from the scale, say, of an insect, if you were a very small caterpillar trying to bore your way into a peach and the moth lays an egg on the fruit, then the little caterpillar, which is obviously tiny, has to negotiate through a very dense thicket of pubescence. That's quite difficult.
The pubescence is what scientists call fuzz.
Fuzz, hair.
Yeah.
And so I think that's been much more thoroughly studied in some other crops. There's no question about it. It's a physical barrier, but there's also certainly chemical defensive compounds present that make it just a little bit more difficult on an insect or perhaps a fungal spore simply because the fuzz vastly increases the surface area of the fruit.
I guess my completely unscientifically educated thought would be that it's harder to hold on to something that's smooth. But if you're that tiny, that's the opposite, right?
I think I would look at it that is very often you've got, for insects, it's something of an obstacle course, and especially when they're tiny, they infest fruit because there's lots of them and the lucky ones survive. The other thing that I would observe, and I'm sure Al could comment on this, if you look at a single drop of dew, for instance, on a peach, it sits up there way up high, and I think it's basically nestled on top of all of the fuzz, which holds it away and allows a bit more of that moisture to evaporate.
Oh, that's really interesting. Well, then let's bring you into this conversation, Al. Your farming goes back in generations in your family. Have you always focused on peaches?
Yes, since the late 1800s, my great-grandfather came in and began to buy land and plant peaches, and we hadn't had enough sense to get out of it. So I'm still in it.
What is it that you think makes the peach successful in the South and especially in Georgia?
Well, it's hard for me to accept that something that is as irritating as fuzz is actually a benefit. But I know it is. I think the worst job I ever had to do was clean fuzz out from under the packing shed. When the process was automated of packing, we had dry brushes that just brushed the fuzz off the peach and blew it up under the packing shed. So then some lucky soul had to crawl up under there and get it out. And I was nominated and elected.
That was you?
That's a bad job.
That sounds like a bad job. Let me put this out to our listeners. Do you prefer a peach or a nectarine? Because we wonder how you feel about the peach fuzz. Irritating, like Al says, does it gross you out? Or, does it kind of feel like a freshly shaven head, kind of cool to touch? Give us your peachy first thoughts at OST Talk on Twitter. You can just call us. Let me bring this back to you, Tom, because you use the fuzz as a jumping off point for all kinds of things, and especially to talk about the environment. One of the things you point out that I find interesting is the fact that part of the reason peaches succeeded because they worked well in tandem with a cotton crop.
That's right.
How does that work?
So the peaches emerged most successfully in the South in the Cotton Belt. And part of that's environmental, but part of that's also, it's actually kind of a social fit as well as an environmental fit. So you can't just have a new crop that fits well with the environment. You also have to have a social system that supports it. In the Cotton Belt, which was not mechanized, you have a lot of people who are working in cotton. And it just so happens that the peach harvest happens at a moment when there's a real lull in the work. And at a moment right before the cotton harvest, which remember, if you're only getting paid once a year, you're probably feeling pretty desperate, right?
Yeah.
So at a moment when you're willing to take any work. Peach growers were paying cash in a lot of cases around the turn of the century, which doesn't happen a lot in the rural South. So it was a good job, and it fit perfectly with the cotton schedule.
Al, did you guys ever branch out into other crops besides peaches?
My father and grandfather always told me if I made any money, I would make it off of a tree. But we have grown some row crops, but the ins and outs of different crops, they need to blend, just like Tom said. Peaches and pecans work real well together, but our other crops kind of get in the way of what we thought was the most important crop, which was peaches.
And I wonder, Dan, as we move on to the relationship with the wildlife, do you call insects wildlife, of Georgia, do we actually have evidence that insects are less interested or less successful at nesting inside a peach?
Well, we have studied some of the primary insect pests of peaches. For instance, Plum curculio, which is a small native weevil, it's a pest. Its actual preference more than anything else is the Chickasaw plum. So it likes the native
I don't know.
Better.
How is a Chickasaw plum different from a plum that I ate in California?
I would leave that either to Tom or perhaps Tom's dad to explain that. There's a lot of hybridization of different plum species to get to the species or to the plums
all
that you would be familiar with.
These ins and outs of fruit. But continue with what you're saying. I'll ask Tom in a second about the Chickasaw plum.
The Chickasaw plum is clearly this insect's favorite. It will sting or lay an egg in at least 90% of the fruit in a plum thicket before it will even wander into an adjacent unsprayed peach orchard. So there are big differences out there. However, one thing I will say about insects that have a fairly narrow host range, they do not starve.
Well,
and if we provide them with a bounty, which a monoculture is, then they will adapt and adapt very well. And there's clear evidence that there are other insects that, for instance, the lesser peach tree borer, which is a pest that attacks the tree, not the fruit.
Oh, I see.
Even though its native hosts are clearly wild plums, it likes the domestic peach, Prunus persica, much better.
And I'm sure Al doesn't like it at all. But let me bring this back to you, Tom. The reason that he's referencing you is because you did not follow your father into his chosen business. You're a history professor. Your dad was a famous peach breeder, correct?
That's right. Yeah.
Which may be the source of your interest in peaches.
Yeah, I grew up in the middle of peach country, but from the kind of the research scientist side of things. So my dad bred peaches. I think about half of the peaches that are grown in the South now are his varieties.
Really?
They usually have the name Prince in them, July Prince, June Prince, Fire Prince.
Al, do you use any of Tom's dad's varieties?
I sure do. We are full of them, and it's been a good bit of work that his father did, and we are appreciative of it.
Okay, so let me go back to you, Tom. He's talking about the attraction of pests to the Chickasaw plum, which is native to the Georgia, whereas the peach is hundreds of years old here, but not originally native.
Right.
So, growing up, this was part of your life, watching your dad breed, hopefully better
That's
peaches
right. Yeah,
all the time.
I went with him to the orchard. I learned to emasculate a peach flower, which is a kind of a skill that not every grade school boy
sounds
gets.
Like something we won't want to delve into without risking FCC fines.
That's right. I think it's fascinating. There's the possibility, and maybe Dan and Al could comment on this, that we've actually bred fuzz out of peaches. The newer peach varieties are much less fuzzy than the old varieties were.
The fuzz used to be longer.
It used to be longer. That's right.
And thicker?
And thicker, I think.
Maybe. Al, your comment on that? Are we breeding out the fuzz?
Yeah, we notice newer varieties they're not fuzzless, but it's much less evident, and I don't think it's as long. And some of it depends on how much rain you get. If it's real dry weather, fuzz tends to build up.
Do less fuzzy peaches sell better?
I don't know if they do or not. I don't think they carry quite as well because they have lost that protective layer of fuzz.
Oh, so maybe that's why nectarines always seem to come bruised. We are talking about peach pubescence on today's show. That is peach fuzz in layman's terms. My guests are, you just heard Al Pearson, who's a peach farmer, also entomologist Dan Horton of UGA, and Tom Oakey. His book is forthcoming. It's called The Georgia Peach, Culture, Agriculture, and Environment in the American South. And Tom, I want to let you talk a little bit more about some of the other implications you've drawn from peach crops in Georgia especially, because you talk about what growing so many peaches and harvesting so many peaches here has done to the composition, the sociological composition in terms of labor of the state. What did you find?
Well, as I was saying, that you had early on, you had this kind of labor surplus at the time when you needed it in peach production in July and August. When cotton mechanized and as African Americans left the South and left the rural South,
this
especially.
This is post-cotton gin.
This, well, cotton gin is early 19th century. This is post-World War II. Actually, we don't really mechanize cotton in the South until after World War II. So people are still hand-picking, doing a lot of hand work. So you have this manual labor force that's there. And peaches, I think part of the reason they got their start so strong in the cotton belt is that they had that labor force that was available. As those workers left, it became more difficult for growers. And I think, Al, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think getting a reliable labor source is probably one of the biggest challenges for growers today, and was really from, say, the 1960s until the guest worker programs of the late 90s and early 2000s.
Al, is that correct, that there was trouble finding workers?
Yeah, it was a gradual change from a completely local labor force to virtually a completely guest worker labor force that comes in under the H-2A program.
All right. We only have a couple seconds left, but I need all of you to tell me what your recommended recipe with peaches is. Al, let me begin with you. What's the best thing to make with peaches?
Pearson peach ice cream.
Okay. Tom?
No question.
Eat them fresh.
Eat them fresh. Yeah. And Dan, do you have a preferred way?
Yes, ma'am. My Aunt Eva's peach dessert, which is basically a cobbler.
And a peach cobbler. Okay. All good suggestions. Tom Oakey is a professor of history at Kennesaw State University, author of the forthcoming book, The Georgia Peach: Culture, Agriculture, and Environment in the American South. We also heard from Al Pearson of Pearson Farms and Dan Horton, professor emeritus of entomology at UGA. Thanks to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. But as always, we love hearing from you. Have a peach recipe to share? If you do, we still might have time to get it on the table in time for Thanksgiving. You can call us at 404-500-9457. Also reach us on Twitter at OST Talk, or just post it to facebook.com/OnSecondThoughtRadio. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.